From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The antipathy shown to the Trump administration by many insiders at the Department of State and Department of Defense, along with the hostility from the media that's been on display since the campaign began in earnest last year, is based in the eyes of many on Trump's foreign policy ideas that diverge with those that have dominated policymaking positions in the U.S. government for the past decades, going back to Zbigniew Brzezinski and perhaps Henry Kissinger. We discuss that with BlackAgendaReport.com columnist Danny Haifong, whose column this week, Trump's Foreign Policy, Continuity or Break, takes a look at what kind of changes, if any, might be in store for U.S. foreign policy.
There's been a lot of conversation about Trump's foreign policy on the left, mostly centering on, right now, his hostilities or his administration's hostilities toward Iran and China. But the conversation has not really dealt with the deep contradictions within Trump's foreign policy that extend all the way back to his campaign, where Trump was very critical, and necessarily so, he had to be critical because in order to differentiate himself from his opponent and honestly all the entire Republican and Democratic Party establishments, he had to say certain things like getting closer in terms of relations with Russia and also opposing regime change efforts in the Middle East and North Africa. This was, he was sort of forced to do this based just on the political conditions that we find ourselves in, where these wars have become increasingly unpopular. And most people in the United States have no idea why the United States is partaking in them at all, given what happens to countries like Libya and Syria, as well as the non-existent threat that Russia poses to the United States at this point. So
yeah, let's probe that for a minute, because what we're talking about here, Trump ran an insurgency campaign that farmed a bunch of available resentment and hostility towards the policies that have been in place for the last 30, 40 years or so. And a lot of attention, ex post facto, but a lot of attention has been given to the dissatisfaction among workers over their economic condition, whether it's unemployment, low wage jobs, massive amounts of debt, foreclosure, et cetera, et cetera. But not much attention at all has been given to the fact that there was widespread dissatisfaction with American foreign policy that was discovered by Trump, because it certainly hasn't been evident in the media, and farmed. And this was evident to us when we were at the Republican National Convention, after having heard Trump say over the course of the campaign things like NATO's outlived its usefulness, let's not have a war with Russia or China, no more regime change, no more nation building, criticizing the not just the Benghazi, which he did, as a dog whistle to the Republican base, but also the very fact of the war on Libya and the war on Syria. And at the convention, when he made the statements, no more regime change, no more nation building, he got a standing ovation from a basketball stadium full of Republican operatives from around the country, which should tell you how prevalent that sentiment is among the general population.
Exactly. And so my piece, because that's exactly where the statements that Trump made comes from. So my piece, what I really try to do is lay out, what has happened so far. How has Trump sort of lived up to his foreign policy, anti-war rhetoric? And it's complicated. And I think it's more complicated than a lot of people will make it out to be. Because right now, what we've seen thus far are some gestures of hostility toward Iran and China that ultimately didn't end up amounting to much. Trump's administration put Iran on notice for two instances that were proven false that it accused Iran of, one being a Houthi attack, a Yemeni attack on a Saudi frigate, another accusation, which is a longstanding accusation that Iran is not living up to its agreement of the P5 plus one, ironically, that the Trump administration is wholly against that and has campaigned mightily against that nuclear deal.
Right.
However, you know, what we're seeing is that the Trump administration laid, honestly, sanctions that have little impact on Iran's economic situation. And Trump has recently backed down from his rhetorical commitment to violating the One China policy after just one conversation with Chinese President Xi Jinping. And I think what this signals is that most people in the United States, and I think most people you know, are honestly getting all their information from the corporate media, so they don't understand that the global situation right now is more complex than what appears on the surface when the corporate media reports it.
Yeah, you know, let me give you a couple of examples here. For example, at the very same time that the media was speculating about Trump and the One China policy and all of that, and this was not just a creature of the media. The Trump administration had floated signals, obviously, intentionally on that point. The CEO of Alibaba, Jack Ma, comes to the United States, meets with Trump, and comes out saying, "Don't worry about it. There's not going to be a problem." You know, and he's a very influential person. He's one of the wealthiest people in China, you know, head of one of the largest corporations in the world. And that was his take after meeting with Trump. So, and while that's happening, there's no analysis given in the media here to the fact that both China has been seeking much closer economic integration successfully with South Korea, and looking to do the same with Japan, that Russia has begun negotiations with Japan to settle some post-war issues like some island disputes and such, that there's that outreach and that tendency going on in the region, and at the same time that Trump is going to be meeting with, as he's meeting this weekend with Abe, you know, all these different players. And it was interesting to me the timing of his conversation with Xi Jinping happening just at the beginning of his meeting with Prime Minister Abe, which, you know, if you think in terms of negotiations, it's a very interesting and complex, almost wheel of you know, variables.
Exactly, and sort of an attempt to balance some of the forces that exist in the world right now. And one of the biggest is that Russia, China, and Iran are allied with each other on many key points economically and militarily.
China and Russia call their alliance a strategic one, which is about as, you know, as deep as it gets. And they're talking across the board, economic, military, political, you know, et cetera.
Exactly. And so all of this really signals that the instability of Trump's administration right now, I don't think has the ability, and some have speculated that Trump, his main interest right now is dividing Russia and China without any real evidence to back up that point. And what that does is it really obfuscates what's going on in the world. It leaves Russia and China in this position of weakness when, in fact, right now, I think it's negotiating in a position of strength. It has been for a while, even during the Obama administration's hostilities against the two countries, which were conducted under conditions of consensus in Washington. There was no protest in Washington against the Obama administration's NATO buildup on the Russian border. There was no protest against the pivot to China.
Right.
In the South Asia Sea, there was none of that.
Right.
So
the installation of THAAD missiles in Korea, the brinksmanship in the South China Sea, all of that. No response really from anyone. And you know what's an interesting aspect to this, as you're working the contradictions, is that the response from the left is not only not nuanced, but it's essentially resist the Trump agenda without dissecting exactly what that is. For example, if part of the Trump agenda is to not have World War III with Russia, is that something that should be resisted?
It's just been silence on that point, really. Or there's been all of this speculation of, oh, Trump doesn't want to do this, Trump doesn't want to do that. He's not really serious about mending relations with Russia. Or there is also the anti-Putin tendencies, which say, oh, well, Putin's going to drop his alliances with Russia, Iran, with China, Iran, and Syria, because those were all based on opportunism, and he'll just cozy up to Trump once.
Ship Snowden over here, too. Ship Snowden over here, yeah, right.
When, in fact, it would be completely not in Russia's interests, right? We have to look at this objectively, not through some Russophobic anti-Putin lens.
Right.
There's no interest on the part of Russia to renege on a lot of its alliances, just given the fact that this is the trend, this is the development that is going to continue to move in that direction, where Russia, China, Iran, you know, they're going to be the ones calling the shots in that region from here on out, because U.S. imperialism has nothing to offer. It has nothing to offer but destruction. It has nothing to offer but complete extraction and, perilous debt. That's all it really can offer on the world stage. And the world has, a lot of the world's nations have awoken to that. Even some of its allies that have long been puppets of the across the African continent, have awoken to this fact that the U.S. is not going to be calling the shots in the economic or military sense in the world.
And I mean, that's a lot of what you're seeing, the hostility, for example, that began getting turned up against Russia, particularly during the Obama administration, but it's been a steady build since 1993, basically. And with all of that going on, you had the effort by the U.S. to when they imposed the sanctions against Russia in 2014, they were saying loudly, we hope that this tanks the Russian economy. And they were having discussions in 2014, 2015 in the Senate about, well, if we take down Rosbank, will that tank their economy, et cetera. In the context of that attempt, China enters into the largest business deal up to that point in history, buying 20 years, I think it was, or 40 years worth of gas, a $500 billion business deal, clearly in the face of those things, saying, don't worry about it, we got your back. And not for nothing, they're building a railroad linking the eastern part of Siberia to Moscow and points west. I don't think in the middle of all of that, the Russian leadership says, oh, I really like hanging out with Trump. I like playing golf with him. Screw these guys. Let's go hang out with them. Knowing that the policy that was directed at them was directed from the elite here, and that elite's membership has not changed, and its goals haven't changed. Perhaps its tactics, for the moment. And so, looking at things realistically, I don't think it's realistic to expect that anybody's going to even try to split them, because it can't be done.
Exactly. And there's been all these rumors about Putin and Russia giving up Snowden, possibly in certain negotiations with Russia, that Trump is going to be, when he finally has this conversation with Vladimir Putin. There's all these rumors going around that honestly just don't understand and don't attempt to understand, because what they're really trying to do is sow this anti-Russia narrative that we are continuously bombarded with by the corporate media, establishment Democrats, and especially a lot of establishment Republicans as well. Who are, honestly trying to destabilize the Trump administration, because for them, the Trump administration is not only an embarrassment, but also he has deviated, even if it is just rhetorically at this moment, right? I don't think we've seen many instances just yet of the Trump administration being able to materialize some of these foreign policy promises, at least not in a large scale. But what we're seeing is just the fact that he said them represents a threat to the Washington consensus. And that, you know, I think that's what's really driving this opposition to Donald Trump at the moment within Washington. And it has to be looked at because, you know, who knows what's going to happen when Trump gets on the phone with Putin, especially after all we just said, where Russia and China are becoming the future of the global order, and the U.S. is increasingly becoming a mere nuisance that happens to be too big for its own, you know, for its own good at this point.
Yep. You know, you mentioned this, attack by the elites on the administration. There's this article that we've discussed in Foreign Policy this past week, Three Ways to Get Rid of President Trump Before 2020. And it starts with first, wait for 2020. So they dropped that from the list because there's actually four. And they also dropped by saying that the fourth one until, you know, they bury the lead. So impeachment, but waiting until 2020, but that's too long with after a catastrophic first week. Then second is impeachment, but gee, that takes too long. Third is to appeal to Mike Pence, that who was ambition, and somehow that will inspire him to end up being president through some undescribed process, or maybe the 25th Amendment, that Trump is unfit to hold office. And then the fourth, this is, you know, what they're throwing out there, a military coup. This is the level of discussion going on in Foreign Policy. So this is a real,
right,
you know, this is a real threat from the powers that be, that's being, you know, not just floated, but like screamed more or less at the administration.
Right. That's just indicative of the desperation right now of the two-party corporate duopoly, but also the entire U.S. imperialist ruling class, which I don't think wants to see 4 years of a Trump presidency for many reasons. And I think the biggest reason is that Trump's very existence is just a signal to the world, especially that this has come in the Foreign Policy Journal, is a signal to the world that the United States is on a precipitous decline that is not going to end. And the Trump administration, I think, has only one interest right now, one objective, and that is to stabilize itself, to figure out some sort of configuration in the policy realm that can maintain and keep power for long enough just to, you know, just to survive under these conditions. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what happens when Trump actually talks to Vladimir Putin, because we already see that Russia has disagreed with the Trump administration's characterization of Iran as the number one terrorist threat in the world.
Right.
And I think that just as the conversation with Xi Jinping ended with a complete reversal of the Trump administration's hostilities toward China and the one China realm, it may in fact also temper some of the hostilities toward Iran, just given the fact that you cannot have, you cannot have amended relationship with Russia if, in fact, you are also hell bent on provoking Iran and targeting Iran as part of your foreign policy agenda. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out, because it once again signals that Russia, China, and Iran, and Russia and China specifically as the leaders, are really driving things in the world. And we have to start talking about this, because U.S. imperialism as a system that Trump now is right smack dab in the middle of and having to lead, because one just doesn't go into a presidential cycle and expect to break completely from U.S. imperialism. That's not possible.
Right.
But
yeah,
it's interesting to see how U.S. imperialism is in a frenzy because Trump is in office. And I don't think this would have happened, let's say Hillary Clinton won, or if some other Republican establishment leader actually took the RNC, the Republican nomination from Trump early in the election. So
Right. We
have to really analyze what this is all about.
You know, just on the point, for example, of the reality on the ground as against the rhetoric. Trump has a conversation 2 weeks ago, I guess, with Putin on the phone. And they're discussing, according to, you know, the readouts of it from both sides, and which are, were limited, by the way. But one of the items that they agreed that was discussed was the possibility of the U.S. and Russia working together to defeat ISIS. Well, you know, the reality is that right now Russia and Iran are fighting ISIS. And so for the U.S. to do that, they would actually be allying, you know, militarily with Iran, strategically, militarily. Whether it's a tactic or not is irrelevant. That the fact is, you can't, on the one hand, be at war with Iran, and on the other hand, be shoulder to shoulder with them on the battlefield against ISIS. And so, Russia, of course, I can't see them contemplating from a military standpoint, forgetting the political standpoint, that, okay, well, we're going to throw Iran over for the fight against ISIS to bring in the United States. Because the reality on the ground is that, Iran is very well represented, you know, in the various places where the battlefield lies. And so, you know, you have to start parsing the rhetoric through the lens of the reality of it and to get an understanding of it, you know. And then when you consider the political conditions that you describe, you know, come into office, there's already a political culture. There's an elite that's entrenched. It has interests in the status quo and the ability to defend itself. It's well represented throughout the bureaucracy and elsewhere in the media. And so you can start to make sense out of what's going on by, you know, moshing all of that together.
Exactly. And I've seen a dangerous trend, I think, even on the independent left spectrum, where there's been a lot of, how should I say, speculation about the Russian Federation and about Putin and about how this moment will inevitably lead, supposedly, to a reconfiguration of Russia's commitments back to the United States and away from its allies. And I think that's a dangerous conversation to have, just because it completely ignores the actual danger of warfare, which rests at the feet of U.S. imperialism and the potential world war, which doesn't rest at the feet of Russia, but in fact, its adversary. And also, what it does is completely distort reality, where Russia, for the last however many years, especially since the Obama administration era, has been fully committed to the territorial and sovereign integrity of nations around the world, and honestly has been one of the more positive players in the world scene that we've seen, maybe the most, over the last 4 or 5 years, especially in regards to Syria, as well as other questions in China as well. So how are we supposed to parse and understand this moment when Russia is still being attacked on all fronts ideologically by those who ultimately have lost the election, those who lost the election, and those who are desperately attempting to seek powers? I mean, we seek power again. I mean, we saw how desperate the Democratic Party was when, during a press conference, Representative Maxine Waters couldn't even regurgitate the anti-Russian narrative in a way that could be convincing. She said that Putin was advancing into Korea and couldn't remember Aleppo. She had her own Aleppo moment. I mean, this is...
Couldn't remember Crimea. She meant Crimea when she said really, Korea. Yeah.
Exactly. This is what's really dangerous about this moment, is that there is the opposition to Trump, which, you know, on the grassroots level should at some point be legitimized and be commended for opposing some very legitimate policies that no one should really be proud of. But at the same time, we have this broader opposition to Trump, which includes a lot of elite elements, includes a lot of establishment elements, which must be categorically opposed because their one objective is to re-legitimize the system, get rid of the embarrassment that is Donald Trump, both in the personal character of who Trump is, but also in a lot of his political positions, which are wholly embarrassing because what they signal is the complete decline of U.S. imperialism and this break with the consensus in Washington that, you know, the U.S. is the most exceptional country in the world, and it ultimately should be the police watchdog of the world. And that is something that Trump wholly challenges just by his mere presence.
Yeah. And finally, the point that you make, in the article towards the end, is which you've stated earlier somewhat, but with respect to people abroad, but the U.S. imperialism has as little to offer the people of the United States as it does to people abroad. I've said a number of times the shorthand for describing the competing models out in the world is looting by the U.S. and EU, and there's such a history of it that you can't, you know, the people on the ground that have been looted, you can't deny it in front of them. They'll just laugh and walk away. Or win-win, which is China's model, which is, we're gonna buy your stuff, but we're gonna build factories there so you have jobs. We want to uplift your population so you can buy more of our stuff, and that's their model. And the two models, competing with each other, do parallel the models being offered by neoliberalism to people in the United States, which is, shuttered factories, foreclosures, evictions, massive student debt, healthcare, unaffordability, all of that, as opposed to what hasn't been delivered yet, but what was promised by Trump, which is jobs, saving Medicare and Social Security, dealing with the health care problem so people have affordable health care. That's great, whatever the hell that means. But something offered, that parallels the kind of split that people are presented with in the international sphere.
Exactly. And a lot of this speculation on the left about, does Trump mean it? Oh, is Trump actually going to make good on his campaign promises is ultimately irrelevant, just given the crisis that you just laid bare, just in terms of the material conditions of workers right now in the United States, is so dire that regardless if Trump even tailors any policies towards his rhetoric, what's really important is that it is these conditions that ultimately got Donald Trump elected. And we can no longer ignore the need to build a program that can speak to workers and that can ultimately ultimately organize them in a fashion that that brings an independent challenge to Washington and the imperialist and capitalist system that it controls. We need to really look at a lot of these dire issues that have been completely ignored by both parties for how many decades. I mean, there was just a study that Glenn Ford has been doing a lot of work around where the for those who are serving felony murder charges or violent felony charges inside of prisons, the length of stay of their prison terms have gone up double since the 80s, right, for the same crime. And so what we're seeing is this lockdown of U.S. imperialism in the United States as well, where the endless drive for austerity, the endless replacement of jobs by technology, the endless misery of working people, and especially black people and people of color in this country, is really coming to a head, where it can no longer go further without deep unrest, deep instability, and the potential for a crisis on the economic realm that will be much bigger.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio,
I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.